Chapter 4. The Priest's Tale Continued. Highways in Hiding. 1. The walk from the backyard of the rectory to the front door of Our Lady of Serenity was a short one, taking no more than 5 minutes. That was surely not enough time for the old fellow to tell them about the years he had spent on the bum before seeing a news story in the Sacramento Bee which had brought him back to New York in 1981, and yet the three gunslingers heard the entire tale nevertheless. Roland suspected that Eddie and Susanna knew what this meant as well as he did. When they moved on from Calla Bryn Sturgis, always assuming they didn't die here, there was every likelihood that Donald Callahan would be moving on with them. This was not just storytelling, but kef, the sharing of water. And leaving the touch, which was a different matter, to one side, kef could only be shared by those whom destiny had welded together for good or for ill. By those who were ka-tet. Callahan said, "Do you know how folks say we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto?"
"The phrase has some vague resonance for us, Sugar."
"Yes," Susanna said dryly.
"Does it? Yes, I see just looking at you that it does. Perhaps you'll tell me your own story some day. I have an idea it would put mine to shame. In any case, I knew I wasn't in Kansas anymore as I approached the far end of the footbridge. And it seemed that I wasn't entering New Jersey either. At least, not the one I'd always expected to find on the other side of the Hudson. There was a newspaper crumpled against the—"
2. Footrail of the bridge, which seems completely deserted except for him, although vehicle traffic on the big suspension bridge to his left is heavy and constant, and Callahan bends to pick it up. The cool wind blowing along the river ruffles his shoulder-length salt-and-pepper hair. There's only one folded sheet, but the top of it's the front page of the Leebrook Register. Callahan has never heard of Leebrook. No reason he should have. He's no New Jersey scholar, hasn't even been over there since arriving in Manhattan the previous year, but he always thought the town on the other side of the GWB was Fort Lee. Then his mind is taken over by the headlines. The one across the top seems right enough. "Racial tensions in Miami ease," it reads. The New York papers have been full of these troubles over the last few days, but what to make of "War of Kites" continues in Teaneck, Hackensack, complete with a picture of a burning building. There's a photo of firemen arriving on a pumper, but they're all laughing. What to make of "President Agnew supports NASA terraform dream"? What to make of the item at the bottom, written in Cyrillic? "What has happened to me?" Callahan asks himself. All through the business of the vampires and the walking dead, even through the appearance of lost pet posters, which clearly refer to him, he has never questioned his sanity. Now, standing on the New Jersey end of this humble and most remarkable footbridge across the Hudson, this footbridge which is being utilized by no one except himself, he finally does. The idea of Spiro Agnew as president is enough all by itself, he thinks, to make anyone with a speck of political sense doubt his sanity. The man resigned in disgrace years ago, even before his boss did. "What has happened to me?" he wonders. But if he's a raving lunatic imagining all of this, he really doesn't want to know. "Bombs away," he says, and tosses the four-page remnant of the Leebrook Register over the railing of the bridge. The breeze catches it and carries it away toward the George Washington. That's reality, he thinks. Right over there. Those cars, those trucks, those Peter Pan charter buses. But then, among them, he sees a red vehicle that appears to be speeding along on a number of circular treads. Above the vehicle's body, it's about as long as a medium-sized school bus, a crimson cylinder is turning. "Bandy," it says on one side, "Brooks," it says on the other. Bandy Brooks. Or Bandy Brooks. What the hell's Bandy Brooks? He has no idea. Nor has he ever seen such a vehicle in his life, and would not have believed such a thing, look at the treads for heaven's sake, would have been allowed on a public highway. So the George Washington Bridge isn't the safe world either. Or, not anymore. Callahan grabs the railing of the footbridge and squeezes down tightly as a wave of dizziness courses through him, making him feel unsteady on his feet and unsure of his balance. The railing feels real enough. Wood warmed by the sun and engraved with thousands of interlocking initials and messages. He sees DKLMB in a heart. He sees Freddy and Helena equals true love. He sees kill all SPIX and NIGERS, the message flanked by swastikas, and wonders at verbal depletion so complete the sufferer cannot even spell his favorite epithets. Messages of hate, messages of love, and all of them as real as the rapid beating of his heart or the weight of the few coins and bills in the right front pocket of his jeans. He takes a deep breath of the breeze, and that's real too, right down to the tang of diesel fuel. This is happening to me, I know it is, he thinks. I am not in some psychiatric hospital's Ward 9, I am me, I am here, and I'm even sober, at least for the time being. And New York is at my back. So is the town of Jerusalem's Lot, Maine, with its uneasy dead. Before me is the weight of America with all its possibilities. This thought lifts him, and is followed by one that lifts him even higher, not just one America, perhaps, but a dozen, or a thousand, or a million. If that's Leebrook over there instead of Fort Lee, maybe there's another version of New Jersey where the town on the other side of the Hudson is Lehman, or Lee Bluffs, or Lee Palisades, or Leghorn Village. Maybe instead of 42 continental United States on the other side of the Hudson, there are 4,200, or 42,000, all of them stacked in vertical geographies of chance. And he understands instinctively that this is almost certainly true. He has stumbled upon a great, possibly endless confluence of worlds. They are all America, but they are all different. There are highways which lead through them, and he can see them. He walks rapidly to the Leebrook end of the footbridge, then pauses again. Suppose I can't find my way back, he thinks. Suppose I get lost and wander and never find my way back to the America where Fort Lee is on the west side of the George Washington Bridge and Gerald Ford, of all people, is the President of the United States. And then he thinks, so what if I do? So fucking what? When he steps off on the Jersey side of the footbridge, he's grinning, truly lighthearted for this first time since the day he presided over Danny Glick's grave in the town of Jerusalem's Lot. A couple of boys with fishing poles are walking toward him. Would one of you young fellows care to welcome me to New Jersey? Callahan asks, grinning more widely than ever. Welcome to NJ, man, one of them says, willingly enough, but both of them give Callahan a wide berth and a careful look. He doesn't blame them, but it doesn't cut into his splendid mood in the slightest. He feels like a man who has been let out of a gray and cheerless prison on a sunny day. He begins to walk faster, not turning around to give the skyline of Manhattan a single goodbye glance. Why would he? Manhattan is the past. The multiple Americas which lie ahead of him, those are the future. He is in Leebrook. There are no chimes. Later there will be chimes and vampires. Later there will be more messages chalked on sidewalks and sprayed on brick walls, not all about him either. Later, he will see the low men in their outrageous red Cadillacs and green Lincolns and purple Mercedes-Benz sedans, low men with red flash-gun eyes, but not today. Today there is sunshine in a new America on the west side of a restored footbridge across the Hudson. On Main Street, he stops in front of the Leebrook Homestyle diner, and there's a sign in the window reading, "Short order cook wanted." Don Callahan short-ordered through most of his time at seminary and did more than his share of the same at home on the east side of Manhattan. He thinks he might fit right in here at the Leebrook home style. Turns out he's right, although it takes three shifts before the ability to crack a pair of eggs one-handed onto the grill comes swimming back to him. The owner, a long drink of water named Dickie Rudebaker, asks Callahan if he has any medical problems. Catching stuff, he calls it, and nods simple acceptance when Callahan says he doesn't. He doesn't ask Callahan for any paperwork, not so much as a social security number. He wants to pay his new short order off the books, if that's not a problem. Callahan assures him it is not.
"One more thing," says Dicky Rudabaker, and Callahan waits for the shoe to drop. Nothing would surprise him, but all Rudabaker says is, "You look like a drinking man."
Callahan allows, as how he has been known, to take a drink.
"So have I," Rudabaker says. "In this business, it's the way you protect your goddamn sanity. I ain't gonna smell your breath when you come in, if you come in on time. Miss coming in on time twice, though, and you're on your way to wherever. I ain't gonna tell you that again."
Callahan short orders at the Leebrook Homestyle Diner for 3 weeks, and stays 2 blocks down at the Sunset Motel. Only it's not always the Homestyle, and it's not always the Sunset. On his 4th day in town, he wakes up in the Sunrise Motel, and the Leebrook Homestyle Diner is the Fort Lee Homestyle Diner. The Leebrook Register, which people have been leaving behind on the counter, becomes the Fort Lee Register American. He is not exactly relieved to discover Gerald Ford has reassumed the presidency. When Rudabaker pays him at the end of his 1st week in Fort Lee, Grant is on the 50s, Jackson is on the 20s, and Alexander Hamilton is on the single 10 in the envelope the boss hands him. At the end of the 2nd week, in Leebrook, Abraham Lincoln is on the 50s, and someone named Chadbourne is on the 10. It's still Andrew Jackson on the 20s, which is something of a relief. In Callahan's motel room, the bed cover is pink in Leebrook and orange in Fort Lee. This is handy. He always knows which version of New Jersey he's in as soon as he wakes up. Twice he gets drunk. The 2nd time after closing, Dicky Rudabaker joins him and matches him drink for drink. "This used to be a great country," the Leebrook version of Rudabaker mourns, and Callahan thinks how great it is that some things don't change. The fundamental bitch and moans apply as time goes by. But his shadow starts getting longer earlier each day. He has seen his first Type 3 vampire waiting in line to buy a ticket at the Leebrook Twin Cinema, and one day he gives notice.
"Thought you told me you didn't have anything," Rudabaker says to Callahan. "Beg your pardon? You've got a bad case of itchy foot, my friend. It often goes with the other thing."
Rudabaker makes a bottle-tipping gesture with one dishwater-reddened hand.
"When a man catches itchy foot late in life, it's often incurable. Tell you what, if I didn't have a wife that's still a pretty good lay and 2 kids in college, I might just pack me a bindle and join you."
"Yeah?" Callahan asks, fascinated.
"September and October are always the worst," Rudabaker says dreamily. "You just hear it calling. The birds hear it, too, and go."
"It?" Rudabaker gives him a look that says don't be stupid.
"With them, it's the sky. Guys like us, it's the road. Call of the open fucking road. Guys like me, kids in school and a wife that still likes it more than just on Saturday night, they turn up the radio a little louder and drown it out. You're not gonna do that."
He pauses, looks at Callahan shrewdly.
"Stay another week? I'll bump you $25. You make a goddamn fine Monte Cristo."
Callahan considers, then shakes his head. If Rudabaker was right, if it was only one road, maybe he would stay another week, and another, and another. But it's not just one, it's all of them, all those highways in hiding, and he remembers the name of his 3rd-grade reader and bursts out laughing. It was called Roads to Everywhere.
"What's so funny?" Rudabaker asks sourly.
"Nothing," Callahan says.
"Everything."
He claps his boss on the shoulder. "You're a good man, Dickie. If I get back this way, I'll stop in."
"You won't get back this way," Dicky Rudabaker says.
And of course, he is right. 3.
"I was 5 years on the road, give or take," Callahan said as they approached his church,
and in a way that was all he said on the subject, yet they heard more. Nor were they surprised later to find that Jake, on his way into town with Eisenhart and the Sleitmans, had heard some of it too. It was Jake, after all, who was strongest in the touch.
5 years on the road, no more than that. And all the rest, do you ken, 1,000 lost worlds of the rose.
4. He's 5 years on the road, give or take, only there's a lot more than one road, and maybe
under the right circumstances, 5 years can be forever. There is Route 71 through Delaware, and apples to pick. There's a little boy named Lars with a broken radio. Callahan fixes it, and Lars's mother packs him a great and wonderful lunch to go on with, a lunch that seems to last for days. There is Route 317 through rural Kentucky, and a job digging graves with a fellow named Pete Pataki, who won't shut up. A girl comes to watch them, a pretty girl of 17 or so, sitting on a rock wall with yellow leaves raining down all around her, and Pete Pataki speculates on what it would be like to have those long thighs stripped of the corduroys they're wearing and wrapped around his neck. What it would be like to be tongue deep in jailbait. Pete Pataki doesn't see the blue light around her. And he certainly doesn't see the way her clothes drift to the ground like feathers later on when Callahan sits beside her, then draws her close as she slips a hand up his leg and her mouth onto his throat, then thrusts his knife unerringly into the bulge of bone and nerve and gristle at the back of her neck. This is a shot he's getting very good at. There is Route 19 through West Virginia, and a little road-dusty carnival that's looking for a man who can fix the rides and feed the animals. "Or the other way around," says Greg Chum, the carny's greasy-haired owner. "You know, feed the rides and fix the animals, whatever floats your boat." And for a while, when a strep infection leaves the carny short-handed, they are swinging down south by now, trying to stay ahead of winter. He finds himself also playing Menso the ESP Wonder, and with surprising success. It is also as Menso that he first sees them, not vampires and not bewildered dead people, but tall men with pale, watchful faces that are usually hidden under old-fashioned hats with brims or new-fashioned baseball hats with extra-long bills. In the shadows thrown by these hats, their eyes flare a dusky red, like the eyes of coons or polecats when you catch them in the beam of a flashlight, lurking around your trash barrels. Do they see him? The vampires, the type threes at least, do not. The dead people do. And these men, with their hands stuffed into the pockets of their long yellow coats and their hard-case faces peering out from beneath their hats, do they see? Callahan doesn't know for sure, but decides to take no chances. 3 days later, in the town of Yazoo City, Mississippi, he hangs up his black Menso top hat, leaves his greasy coverall on the floor of a pickup truck's camper cap, and blows Chum's traveling wonder show, not bothering with the formality of his final paycheck. On his way out of town, he sees a number of those pet posters nailed to telephone poles. A typical one reads, "Lost. Siamese cat. 2 years old." Answers to the name of Ruta. She is noisy but full of fun. Large reward offered. Dial 764, wait for beep, give your number. God bless you for helping. Who is Ruta? Callahan doesn't know. All he knows is that she is noisy but full of fun. Will she still be noisy when the low men catch up to her? Will she still be full of fun? Callahan doubts it. But he has his own problems, and all he can do is pray to the God in whom he no longer strictly believes that the men in the yellow coats won't catch up to her. Later that day, thumbing on the side of Route 3 in Issaquena County under a hot gunmetal sky that knows nothing of December and approaching Christmas, the chimes come again. They fill his head, threatening to pop his eardrums and blow pinprick hemorrhages across the entire surface of his brain. As they fade, a terrible certainty grips him. They are coming. The men with the red eyes and big hats and long yellow coats are on their way. Callahan bolts from the side of the road like a chain gang runaway, clearing the pond scummy ditch like Superman, at a single bound. Beyond is an old stake fence overgrown with drifts of kudzu and what might be poison sumac. He doesn't care if it's poison sumac or not. He dives over the fence, rolls over in high grass and burdocks, and peers out at the highway through a hole in the foliage. For a moment or two, there's nothing. Then, a white over red Cadillac comes pounding down Highway 3 from the direction of Yazoo City. It's doing 70 easy, and Callahan's peephole is small, but he still sees them with supernatural clarity. Three men,
two in what appear to be yellow dusters, the third in what might be a flight jacket. All three are smoking. The Cadillac's closed cabin fumes with it.
"They'll see me. They'll hear me. They'll sense me," Callahan's mind yammers, and he forces it away from its own panicky, wretched certainty, yanks it away.
He forces himself to think of that Elton John song, "Someone saved, someone saved, someone saved my life tonight," and it seems to work. There is one terrible, heart-stopping moment when he thinks the caddy is slowing. Long enough for him to imagine them chasing him through this weedy, forgotten field, chasing him down, dragging him into an abandoned shed or barn. And then the caddy roars over the next hill, headed for Natchez, maybe, or Copaya. Callahan waits another 10 minutes. "Gotta make sure they're not tricking on you, man," Lupe might have said. But even as he waits, he knows this is only a formality. They're not tricking on him. They flat missed him. How? Why? The answer dawns on him slowly. An answer, at least, and he's damned if it doesn't feel like the right one. They missed him because he was able to slip into a different version of America as he lay behind the tangle of kudzu and sumac, peering out at Route 3. Maybe different in only a few small details. Lincoln on the 1 and Washington on the 5 instead of the other way around, let us say. But enough. Just enough. And that's good, because these guys aren't brain-blasted like the dead folks, or blind to him like the blood-sucking folks. These people, whoever they are the most dangerous of all. Finally, Callahan goes back out to the road. Eventually, a black man in a straw hat and overalls comes driving along in an old beat-up Ford. He looks so much like a Negro farmer from a 30s movie that Callahan almost expects him to laugh and slap his knee and give out occasional cries of, "Yes, sir, boss, ain't that the truth?" Instead, the black man engages him in a discussion about politics, prompted by an item on National Public Radio to which he is listening. And when Callahan leaves him in Shady Grove, the black man gives him $5 and a spare baseball cap. "I have money," Callahan says, trying to give back the 5. "A man on the run never has enough," says the black man. "And please don't tell me you're not on the run. Don't insult my intelligence." "I thank you," Callahan says. "De nada," says the black man. "Where are you going, roughly speaking?"
"I don't have a clue," Callahan replies, then smiles. "Roughly speaking."
5. Picking oranges in Florida. Pushing a broom in New Orleans. Mucking out horse stalls in Lufkin, Texas. Handing out real estate brochures on street corners in Phoenix, Arizona. Working jobs that pay cash, observing the ever-changing faces on the bills. Noting the different names in the papers. Jimmy Carter is elected president, but so are Ernest, Fritz Hollings, and Ronald Reagan. George Bush is also elected president. Gerald Ford decides to run again, and he is elected president. The names in the papers, those of the celebrities, change the most frequently, and there are many he has never heard of, don't matter. The faces on the currency don't matter. What matters is the sight of a weather vane against a violent pink sunset, the sound of his heels on an empty road in Utah, the sound of the wind in the New Mexico desert. The sight of a child skipping rope beside a junked-out Chevrolet Caprice and Fossil Oregon. What matters is the whine of the power lines beside Highway 50 west of Elko, Nevada, and a dead crow in a ditch outside Rain Barrel Springs. Sometimes he's sober, and sometimes he gets drunk. Once he lays up in an abandoned shed, this is just over the California state line from Nevada, and drinks for 4 days straight. It ends with 7 hours of off-and-on vomiting. For the first hour or so, the puking is so constant and so violent, he is convinced it will kill him. Later on, he can only wish it would. And when it's over, he swears to himself that he's done. No more booze for him. He's finally learned his lesson. And a week later, he's drunk again, and staring up at the strange stars behind the restaurant where he has hired on as a dishwasher. He is an animal in a trap, and he doesn't care. Sometimes there are vampires, and sometimes he kills them. Mostly he lets them live, because he's afraid of drawing attention to himself, the attention of the low men. Sometimes he asks himself what he thinks he's doing, where the hell he's going, and such questions are apt to send him in search of the next bottle in a hurry. Because he's really not going anywhere. He's just following the highways in hiding and dragging his trap along behind him. He's just listening to the call of those roads and going from one to the next. Trapped or not, sometimes he is happy. Sometimes he sings in his chains like the sea. He wants to see the next weather vane standing against the next pink sunset. He wants to see the next silo crumbling at the end of some disappeared farmer's long-abandoned north field and see the next droning truck with Tonopah gravel or Asplund heavy construction written on the side. He's in hobo heaven, lost in the split personalities of America. He wants to hear the wind in canyons and know that he's the only one who hears it. He wants to scream and hear the echoes run away. When the taste of Barlow's blood is too strong in his mouth, he wants to drink. And of course, when he sees the lost pet posters or the messages chalked on the sidewalks, he wants to move on. Out west he sees fewer of them, and neither his name nor his description is on any of them. From time to time he sees vampires cruising, give us this day our daily blood, but he leaves them be. They're mosquitoes, after all. No more than that. In the spring of 1981, he finds himself rolling into the city of Sacramento in the back of what may be the oldest International Harvester steak bed truck still on the road in California. He's crammed in with roughly 36 Mexican illegals. There is mezcal and tequila and pot and several bottles of wine. They're all drunk and done up, and Callahan is perhaps the drunkest of them all. The names of his companions come back to him in later years like names spoken in a haze of fever. Escobar, Estrada, Javier, Esteban, Rosario, Echeverria, Cavera. Are they all names he will later encounter in the Cala, or is that just a booze hallucination? For that matter, what is he to make of his own name, which is so close to that of the place where he finishes up? Cala Callahan. Cala Callahan. Sometimes, when he's long getting to sleep in his pleasant rectory bed, the two names chase each other in his head like the tigers in Little Black Sambo. Sometimes a line of poetry comes to him, a paraphrase from, he thinks, Archibald MacLeish's Epistle to be Left in Earth. It was not the voice of God, but only the thunder. That's not right, but it's how he remembers it, not God, but the thunder. Or is that only what he wants to believe? How many times has God been denied just that way? In any case, all of that comes later. When he rolls into Sacramento, he's drunk and he's happy. There are no questions in his mind. He's even halfway happy the next day, hangover and all. He finds a job easily. Jobs are everywhere, it seems, lying around like apples after a windstorm has gone through the orchard. As long as you don't mind getting your hands dirty, that is, or scalded by hot water, or sometimes blistered by the handle of an axe or a shovel. In his years on the road, no one has ever offered him a stockbroker's job. The work he gets in Sacramento is unloading trucks at a block-long bed and mattress store called Sleepy John's. Sleepy John is preparing for his once-yearly mattress massacre, and all morning long Callahan and a crew of five other men haul in the kings and queens and doubles. Compared to some of the day labor he's done over the last years, this job is a tit. At lunch, Callahan and the rest of the men sit in the shade of the loading dock. So far as he can tell, there's no one in this crew from the International Harvester, but he wouldn't swear to it. He was awfully drunk. All he knows for sure is that he's once again the only guy present with a white skin. All of them are eating enchiladas from Crazy Mary's down the road. There's a dirty old boombox sitting on a pile of crates playing salsa. Two young men tango together while the others, Callahan included, put aside their lunches so they can clap along. A young woman in a skirt and blouse comes out, watches the men dance disapprovingly, then looks at Callahan. "You're Anglo, right?" she says. "Anglo as the day is long," Callahan agrees. "Then maybe you'd like this. Certainly no good to the rest of them." She hands him the newspaper.
the Sacramento Bee, then looks at the dancing Mexicans.
Beaners, she says,
and the subtext is in the tone. What can you do? Callahan considers rising to his feet and kicking her narrow can't-dance Anglo ass for her, but it's noon, too late in the day to get another job if he loses this one. And even if he doesn't wind up in the calabozo for assault, he won't get paid. He settles for giving her turned back the finger and laughs when several of the men applaud. The young woman wheels, looks at them suspiciously, then goes back inside. Still grinning, Callahan shakes open the paper. The grin lasts until it gets to the page marked National Briefs, then fades in a hurry. Between a story about a train derailment in Vermont and a bank robbery in Missouri, he finds this. Award-winning street angel, critical. New York, AP. Rowan R. Magruder, owner and chief supervisor of what may be America's most highly regarded shelter for the homeless, alcoholic, and drug addicted, is in critical condition after being assaulted by the so-called Hitler brothers. The Hitler brothers have been operating in the five boroughs of New York for at least 8 years. According to police, they are believed responsible for over 36 assaults and the deaths of 2 men. Unlike their other victims, Magruder is neither black nor Jewish, but he was found in a doorway not far from home, the shelter he founded in 1968, with the Hitler brothers' trademark swastika cut into his forehead. Magruder had also suffered multiple stab wounds. Home gained nationwide notice in 1977 when Mother Teresa visited, helped to serve dinner, and prayed with the clients. Magruder himself was the subject of a Newsweek cover story in 1980 when the East Side's so-called street angel was named Manhattan's Man of the Year by Mayor Ed Koch. A doctor familiar with the case rated Magruder's chances of pulling through as no higher than 3 in 10. He said that as well as being branded, Magruder was blinded by his assailants. "I think of myself as a merciful man," the doctor said, "but in my opinion, the men who did this should be beheaded." Callahan reads the article again, wondering if this is his Rowan Magruder or another one. A Rowan Magruder from a world where a guy named Chadbourne is on some of the greenbacks, say. He's somehow sure that it's his and that he was meant to see this particular item. Certainly, he is in what he thinks of as the real world now, and it's not just the thin sheaf of currency in his wallet that tells him so. It's a feeling, a kind of tone, a truth. If so, and it is so, he knows it, how much he has missed out here on the hidden highways. Mother Teresa came to visit, helped to ladle out soup. Hell, for all Callahan knows, maybe she cooked up a big old mess of toads and dumplings. Could've. The recipe was right there, scotch-taped to the wall beside the stove. And an award, the cover of Newsweek. He's pissed he didn't see that, but you don't see the news magazines very regularly when you're traveling with the carnival and fixing the crazy cups or mucking up the bull stalls behind the rodeo in Enid, Oklahoma. He is so deeply ashamed that he doesn't even know he's ashamed. Not even when Juan Castillo says, "Why'd you cry, Donnie?" "Am I?" he asks, and wipes underneath his eyes, and yeah, he is crying. But he doesn't know it's for shame, not then. He assumes it's shock, and probably part of it is. "Yeah, I guess I am." "Where'd you going?" Juan persists. "Lunch break's almost over, man." "I have to leave," Callahan says. "I have to go back east."
"You take off, they ain't gonna pay you."
"I know," Callahan says. "It's okay." And what a lie that is. Because nothing's okay. Nothing. 6. "I had a couple of $100 sewn into the bottom of my backpack," Callahan said. They were now sitting on the steps of the church in the bright sunshine. "I bought an airplane ticket back to New York. Speed was of the essence, of course, but that really wasn't the only reason. I had to get off those highways in hiding." He gave Eddie a small nod. "The Toadash Turnpikes. They're as addictive as the booze."
"More," Roland said. He saw 3 figures coming toward them, Rosalita, shepherding the Tavery twins, Frank and Francine.
The girl had a large sheet of paper in her hands, and was carrying it out in front of her with an air of reverence that was almost comic. Wandering's the most addictive drug there is, I think. And every hidden road leads on to a dozen more.
You say true, I say thank you, Callahan replied.
He looked gloomy and sad and, Roland thought, a little lost. Pear, we'd hear the rest of your tale, but I'd have you save it until evening, or tomorrow evening, if we don't get back until then. Our young friend Jake will be here shortly.
You know that, do you?
Callahan asked, interested but not disbelieving.
Aye, Susanna said.
I'd see what you have in there before he comes, Roland said. The story of how you came by it is part of your story, I think.
Yes, Callahan said, it is. The point of my story, I think.
And must wait its place. As for now, things are stacking up.
They have a way of doing that, Callahan said. For months, sometimes even years, as I tried to explain to you, time hardly seems to exist. Then everything comes in a gasp.
You say true, Roland said. Step over with me to see the twins, Eddie. I believe the young lady has her eye on you.
She can look as much as she wants, Susanna said good-humoredly. Looking's free. I might just sit here in the sun on these steps, Roland, if it's all the same to you. Been a long time since I rode, and I don't mind telling you that I'm saddle-sore. Not having any lower pins seems to put everything else out of whack.
Do you either way, Roland said. But he didn't mean it, and Eddie knew he didn't. The gunslinger wanted Susanna to stay right where she was for the time being. He could only hope Susanna wasn't catching the same vibe. As they walked toward the children and Rosalita, Roland spoke to Eddie, low and quick. I'm going into the church with him by myself. Just know that it's not the both of you I want to keep away from whatever's in there. If it is Black 13, and I believe it must be, it's best she not go near it.
Given her delicate condition, you mean?
Roland, I would have thought Sue's having a miscarriage would almost be something you'd want. Roland said, it's not a miscarriage that concerns me. I'm worried about Black 13 making the thing inside her even stronger. He paused again. Both things, mayhap. The baby and the baby's keeper.
Mia.
Yes. Her. Then he smiled at the Tavery twins. Francine gave him a perfunctory smile in return, saving full wattage for Eddie. Let me see what you've made, if you would, Roland said.
Frank Tavery said, we hope it's all right. Might not be. We were afraid, do you? It's such a wonderful piece of paper the missus gave us, we were afraid. We drew on the ground first, Francine said, then in lightest char. 'Twas Frank did the final, my hands are all a-shake.
No fear, Roland said. Eddie drew close and looked over his shoulder. The map was a marvel of detail, with the town gathering hall and the common at the center and the big River Divartiti running along the left side of the paper, which looked to Eddie like an ordinary mimeosheet, the kind available by the ream at any office supply store in America.
"Kids, this is absolutely terrific," Eddie said, and for a moment he thought Francine Tavery might actually faint.
"Aye," Roland said, "you've done a great service. And now I'm going to do something that will probably look like blasphemy to you. You know the word?"
"Yes," Frank said. "We're Christians. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God or his Son, the man Jesus, in vain. But blasphemy is also to commit a rude act upon a thing of beauty."
His tone was deeply serious, but he looked interested to see what blasphemy the outworlder meant to commit. His sister did, too. Roland folded the paper, which they had almost dared not touch in spite of their obvious skill, in half. The children gasped, so did Rosalita Munoz, although not quite as loudly. "It's not blasphemy to treat it so, because it's no longer just paper," Roland said. "It has become a tool. And tools must be protected, do you ken?"
"Yes,"
they said, but doubtfully. Their confidence was at least partly restored by the care with which Roland stowed the folded map in his purse. "Thank you, big," Roland said. He took Francine's hand in his left, Frank's in his diminished right. "You may have saved lives with your hands and eyes." Francine burst into tears. Frank held his own back until he grinned, then they overspilled and ran down his freckled cheeks. 7.
Walking back to the church steps, Eddie said, "Good kids. Talented kids." Roland nodded. "Can you see one of them coming back from Thunderclap a drooling idiot?" Roland, who could see it all too well, made no reply. 8. Susanna accepted Roland's decision that she and Eddie should stay outside the church with no argument, and the gunslinger found himself remembering her reluctance to enter the vacant lot. He wondered if part of her was afraid of the same thing he was. If that was the case, the battle, her battle, had already begun.
"How long before I come in and drag you out?" Eddie asked.
"Before we come in and drag you out," Susanna corrected him. Roland considered it was a good question. He looked at Callahan, who stood on the top step in blue jeans and a plaid shirt rolled to the elbows. His hands were clasped in front of him. Roland saw good muscle on those forearms.
The old fellow shrugged. "It sleeps. There should be no problem. But—" He unlocked one of his gnarled hands and pointed at the gun on Roland's hip. "I should ditch that. Mayhap it sleeps with one eye open."
Roland unbuckled the gun belt and handed it to Eddie, who was wearing the other one. Then he unslung his purse and handed it to Susanna. 5 minutes, he said. "If there's trouble, I might be able to call. Or I might not," he didn't add.
"Jake should be here by then," Eddie said.
"If they come, hold them out here," Roland told him.
"Eisenhart and the Slightmans won't try to come in," Callahan said. "What worship they have is for Eriza. Lady Rice."
He grimaced to show what he thought of Lady Rice and the rest of the Kala's second-rate gods. "Let's go, then," Roland said. 9. It had been a long time since Roland Deschain had been afraid in the deeply superstitious way that goes with a believed religion. Since his childhood, perhaps. But fear fell upon him as soon as Père Callahan opened the door of his modest wooden church and held it, gesturing for Roland to precede him inside. There was a foyer with a faded rug on the floor. On the other side of the foyer, two doors stood open. Beyond them was a largish room with pews on each side and kneelers on the floor. At the room's far end was a raised platform and what Roland thought of as a lectern flanked by pots of white flowers. Their mild scent pervaded the still air. There were narrow windows of clear glass. Behind the lectern on the far wall was an ironwood cross. He could hear the old fellow's secret treasure, not with his ears, but with his bones. A steady, low hum. Like the rose, that hum conveyed a sense of power, but it was like the rose in no other way. This hum spoke of colossal emptiness. A void like the one they had all sensed behind the surface reality of Todash, New York. A void that could become a voice. "Yes, this is what took us," he thought. "It took us to New York, one New York of many, according to Callahan's story, but it could take us anywhere or anywhen. It could take us, or it could fling us." He remembered the conclusion of his long palaver with Walter in the place of the bones. He had gone Todash then, too. He understood that now. And there had been a sense of growing, of swelling, until he had been bigger than the earth, the stars, the very universe itself. That power was here, in this room. And he was afraid of it. "Gods grant it sleep," he thought, but the thought was followed by an even more dismaying one. Sooner or later, they would have to wake it up. Sooner or later, they would have to use it to get back to the New York whens they needed to visit. There was a bowl of water on a stand beside the door. Callahan dipped his fingers, then crossed himself.
"You can do that now?"
Roland murmured in what was little more than a whisper.
"Aye," Callahan said. "God has taken me back, gunslinger. Although I think only on what might be called a trial basis, do you ken?"
Roland nodded. He followed Callahan into the church without dipping his fingers in the font. Callahan led him down the center aisle, and although he moved swiftly and surely, Roland sensed the man was as frightened as Roland was himself, perhaps more.
The religious wanted to be rid of the thing, of course, there was that, but Roland still gave him high marks for courage. On the far right side of the preacher's cove was a little flight of three steps. Callahan mounted them.
No need for you to come up, Roland. You can see well enough from where you are. You'd not have it this minute, I can.
Not at all, Roland said. Now they were whispering.
Good.
Callahan dropped to one knee. There was an audible pop as the joint flexed, and they both started at the sound.
I'd not even touch the box it's in if I don't have to. I haven't since I put it here, the hidey hole I made myself, asking God's pardon for using a saw in his house.
Take it up, Roland said. He was on complete alert, every sense drawn fine, feeling and listening for any slightest change in that endless void hum. He missed the weight of the gun on his hip. Did the people who came here to worship not sense the terrible thing the old fellow had hidden here? He supposed they must not, or they'd stay away. And he supposed there was really no better place for such a thing. The simple faith of the parishioners might neutralize it to some degree, might even soothe it and thus deepen its doze. But it could wake up, Roland thought. Wake up and send them all to the 19 points of nowhere in the blink of an eye. This was an especially terrible thought, and he turned his mind from it. Certainly the idea of using it to secure protection for the Rose seemed more and more like a bitter joke. He had faced both men and monsters in his time, but had never been close to anything like this. The sense of its evil was terrible, almost unmanning. The sense of its malevolent emptiness was far, far worse. Callahan pressed his thumb into the groove between two boards. There was a faint click, and a section of the preacher's cove popped out of place. Callahan pulled the boards free, revealing a square hole roughly 15 inches long and wide. He rocked back on his haunches, holding the boards across his chest. The hum was much louder now. Roland had a brief image of a gigantic hive with bees the size of wagons crawling sluggishly over it. He bent forward and looked into the old fellow's hidey hole. The thing inside was wrapped in white cloth, fine linen from the look of it.
"An altar boy's surplice," Callahan said.
Then, seeing Roland didn't know the word,
"A thing to wear,"
he shrugged.
"My heart said to wrap it up, and so I did."
"Your heart surely said true,"
Roland whispered. He was thinking of the bag Jake had brought out of the vacant lot, the one with nothing but stripes at mid-world lanes on the side. They would need it, aye and aye, but he didn't like to think of the transfer. Then he put thought aside, fear as well, and folded back the cloth. Beneath the surplice, wrapped in it, was a wooden box. Despite his fear, Roland reached out to touch that dark, heavy wood. It will be like touching some lightly oiled metal, he thought, and it was. He felt an erotic shiver shake itself deep inside him. It kissed his fear like an old lover and then was gone.
"This is black ironwood," Roland whispered. "I have heard of it, but never seen it." "In my tales of Arthur, it's called ghostwood,"
Callahan whispered back.
"Aye, is it so?"
Certainly the box had a ghostly air to it, as of something derelict which had come to rest, however temporarily, after long wandering. The gunslinger very much would have liked to give it a second caress. The dark, dense wood begged his hand, but he had heard the vast hum of the thing inside rise a notch before falling back to its former drone. The wise man doesn't poke a sleeping bear with a stick, he told himself. It was true. But it didn't change what he wanted. He did touch the wood once more, lightly, with just the tips of his fingers, then smelled them. There was an aroma of camphor and fire, and, he would have sworn it, the flowers of the far north country, the ones that bloom in the snow. Three objects had been carved on top of the box: a rose, a stone, and a door. Beneath the door was this: Unfound. Roland reached out again. Callahan made a move forward as if to stop him, and then subsided. Roland touched the carving beneath the image of the door. Again the hum beneath it rose, the hum of the black ball hidden inside the box. Un? He whispered, and ran the ball of his thumb across the raised symbols again. Unfound. Not what he read, but what his fingertips heard.
Yes, I'm sure that's what it says,
Callahan whispered back. He looked pleased, but still grasped Roland's wrist and pushed it, wanting the gunslinger's hand away from the box. A fine sweat had broken on his brow and forearms.
It makes sense in a way. A leaf, a stone, an unfound door, they're symbols in a book from my side. Look, Homeward Angel, it's called.
A leaf, a stone, a door, Roland thought. Only substitute rose for leaf. Yes, that feels right.
Will you take it? Callahan asked.
Only his voice rose slightly now, out of its whisper, and the gunslinger realized he was begging. You've actually seen it, Pear, have you?
Aye, once. It's horrible beyond telling, like the slick eye of a monster that grew outside God's shadow. Will you take it, gunslinger?
Yes.
When?
Faintly, Roland heard the chime of bells, a sound so beautifully hideous it made you want to grind your teeth against it. For a moment, the walls of Père Callahan's church wavered. It was as if the thing in the box had spoken to them. Do you see how little it all matters? How quickly and easily I can take it all away, should I choose to do so? Beware, gunslinger. Beware, shaman. The abyss is all around you. You float or fall into it at my whim. Then the common were gone.
When?
Callahan reached over the box in its hole and grasped Roland's shirt.
When?
Soon, Roland said. Too soon, his heart replied. Chapter 5 The Tale of Grey Dick 1 Now it's 23. Roland thought that evening as he sat behind Eisenhart's rocking bee, listening to the boys shout and oi bark. Back in Gilead, this sort of porch behind the main house, facing the barns and the fields, would have been called the work stoop. 23 days until the wolves. And how many until Susanna falls? A terrible idea concerning that had begun to form in his head. Suppose Mia, the new she inside Susanna's skin, were to give birth to her monstrosity on the very day the wolves appeared. One wouldn't think that likely, but according to Eddie, coincidence had been cancelled. Roland thought he was probably right about that. Certainly there was no way to gauge the thing's period of gestation. Even if it had been a human child, 9 months might no longer be 9 months. Time had grown soft.
"Boys," Eisenhart bawled. "What in the name of the man Jesus am I going to tell my wife if you kill your sad selves jumping out of that barn?"
"We're okay," Benny Sleitman called. "Andy won't let us get hurt."
The boy, dressed in bib overalls and barefooted, was standing in the open bay of the barn, just above the carved letters which said Rocking Bee.
"Unless—do you really want us to stop, Si?"
Eisenhart glanced toward Roland, who saw Jake standing just behind Benny, impatiently waiting his chance to risk his bones. Jake was also dressed in bib overalls, a pair of his new friends, no doubt, and the look of them made Roland smile. Jake wasn't the sort of boy you imagined in such clothes, somehow.
"It's nil to me, one way or the other, if that's what you want to know," Roland said.
"Garn, then," the rancher called.
Then he turned his attention to the bits and pieces of hardware spread out on the boards.
"What do you think? Will any of them shoot?"
Eisenhart had produced all three of his guns for Roland's inspection. The best was the rifle the rancher had brought to town on the night he and Jaffords had called the meeting. The other two were pistols of the sort Roland and his friends had called barrel shooters as children, because of the oversized cylinders which had to be revolved with the side of the hand after each shot. Roland had disassembled Eisenhart's shooting irons with no initial comment. Once again, he had set out gun oil, this time in a bowl instead of a saucer.
"I said—"
"I heard you, Si," Roland said. "Your rifle is as good as I've seen this side of the great city. The barrel shooters—" He shook his head. "That one with the nickel plating might fire. The other you might as well stick in the ground. Maybe it'll grow something better."
"Hate to hear you speak so," Eisenhart said,
These were from my dad and his dad before him, and on back, at least this many.
He raised 7 fingers and 1 thumb.
That's back to before the wolves, you can. They was always kept together and passed to the likeliest son by dead letter. When I got him instead of my elder brother, I was some pleased.
Did you have a twin? Roland asked.
Aye, Verna, Eisenhart said.
He smiled easily and often, and did so now beneath his great graying bush of a mustache, but it was painful. The smile of a man who doesn't want you to know he's bleeding somewhere inside his clothes.
She was lovely as dawn, so she was. Passed on these 10 year or more. Went painful early, as the ruined ones often do.
I'm sorry.
Say thank you.
The sun was going down red in the southwest, turning the yard the color of blood. There was a line of rockers on the porch. Eisenhart was settled in one of them. Roland sat cross-legged on the boards, housekeeping Eisenhart's inheritance. That the pistols would probably never fire meant nothing to the gunslinger's hands, which had been trained to this work long ago, and still found it soothing. Now, with a speed that made the rancher blink, Roland put the weapons back together in a rapid series of clicks and clacks. He set them aside on a square of sheepskin, wiped his fingers on a rag, and sat in the rocker next to Eisenhart's. He guessed that on more ordinary evenings, Eisenhart and his wife sat out here side by side, watching the sun abandon the day. Roland rummaged through his purse for his tobacco pouch, found it, and built himself a cigarette with Callahan's fresh, sweet tobacco. Rosalita had added her own present, a little stack of delicate corn shuck wraps she called pulls. Roland thought they wrapped as good as any cigarette paper, and he paused a moment to admire the finished product before tipping the end into the match Eisenhart had popped alight with one horny thumbnail. The gunslinger dragged deep and exhaled a long plume that rose but slowly in the evening air, which was still and surprisingly muggy for summer's end.
Good, he said, and nodded. Aye, may it do you fine. I never got the taste for it myself.
The barn was far bigger than the ranch house, at least 50 yards long and 50 feet high. The front was festooned with reap charms in honor of the season. Stuffy guys with huge sharp root heads stood guard. From above the open bay over the main doors, the butt of the head beam jutted. A rope had been fastened around this. Below, in the yard, the boys had built a good-sized stack of hay. Oi stood on one side of it, Andy on the other. They were both looking up as Benny Sleitman grabbed the rope, gave it a tug, then retreated back into the loft and out of sight. Oi began to bark in anticipation. A moment later, Benny came pelting forward with the rope wrapped in his fists and his hair flying out behind him.
"Gilead and the Eld!" he cried and leaped from the bay.
He swung into the red sunset air with his shadow trailing behind him.
"Ben! Ben!"
Oi barked.
"Ben! Ben! Ben!"
The boy let go, flew into the haystack, disappeared, then popped up laughing. Andy offered him a metal hand, but Benny ignored it, flopping out onto the hard-packed earth. Oi ran around him, barking.
"Do they always call so at play?" Roland asked.
Eisenhart snorted laughter.
"Not at all. Usually it's a cry of Oriza, or Man Jesus, or Hail the Kala, or all three. Your boy's been filling Sleitman's boy full of tales, thinks I."
Roland ignored the slightly disapproving note in this, and watched Jake reel in the rope. Benny lay on the ground, playing dead, until Oi licked his face. Then he sat up, giggling. Roland had no doubt that if the boy had gone off course, Andy would have snagged him. To one side of the barn was a remuda of workhorses, perhaps 20 in all. A trio of cowpokes and chaps and battered shore boots were leading the last half-dozen mounts toward it. On the other side of the yard was a slaughter pen filled with steers. In the following weeks, they would be butchered and sent downriver on the trading boats. Jake retreated into the loft, then came pelting forward.
"New York!" he shouted. "Times Square! Empire State Building! Twin Towers! Statue of Liberty!"
And he launched himself into space along the arc of the rope. They watched him disappear, laughing, into the pile of hay.
"Any particular reason you wanted your other two to stay with the Jeffersons?"
Eisenhart asked. He spoke idly, but Roland thought this was a question that interested him more than a little.
Best we spread ourselves around. Let as many as possible get a good look at us. Time is short. Decisions must be made. All of which was true, but there was more, and Eisenhart probably knew it. He was shrewder than Overholser. He was also dead set against standing up to the wolves, at least so far. This didn't keep Roland from liking the man, who was big and honest and possessed of an earthy countryman's sense of humor. Roland thought he might come around if he could be shown they had a chance to win. On their way out to the Rocking Bee, they had visited half a dozen smallhold farms along the river where rice was the main crop. Eisenhart had performed the introductions good-naturedly enough. At each stop, Roland had asked the two questions he had asked the previous night at the pavilion. Will you open to us if we open to you? Do you see us for what we are and accept us for what we do? All of them had answered yes. Eisenhart had also answered yes. But Roland knew better than to ask the third question of any. There was no need to, not yet. They still had over 3 weeks. "We bide, gunslinger," Eisenhart said. "Even in the face of the wolves, we bide. Once there was Gilead, and now there's Gilead no more. None knows better than you, but still we bide. If we stand against the wolves, all that may change. To you and yours, what happens along the crescent might not mean as much as a fart in a high wind, one way or the other. If you win and survive, you'll move along. If you lose and die, we have no way to go." "But—" Eisenhart raised his hand. "Hear me, I beg. Would you hear me?" Roland nodded, resigned to it. And for him to speak was probably for the best. Beyond them, the boys were running back into the barn for another leap. Soon, the coming dark would put an end to their game. The gunslinger wondered how Eddie and Susanna were making out. Had they spoken to Tien's grand-père yet? And if so, had he told them anything of value? "Suppose they send 50 or even 60, as they have before, many and many a, and suppose we wipe them out. And then suppose that a week or a month later, after you're gone, they send 500 against us." Roland considered the question. As he was doing so, Margaret Eisenhart joined them. She was a slim woman, 40-ish, small-breasted, dressed in jeans and a shirt of gray silk. Her hair, pulled back in a bun against her neck, was black threaded with white. One hand hid beneath her apron.
"That's a fair question," she said, "but this might not be a fair time to ask it. Give him and his friends a week, why don't you, to peek about and see what they may see."
Eisenhart gave his sigh a look that was half humorous and half irritated.
"Do I tell ye how to run your kitchen, woman? When to cook and when to wash?" "Only 4 times a week," said she.
Then, seeing Roland rise from the rocker next to her husband's,
"Nay, sit still, I beg you. I've been in a chair this last hour, peeling sharproot with Edna, Jan's auntie."
She nodded in Benny's direction.
"It's good to be on my feet."
She watched, smiling, as the boys swung out into the pile of hay and landed, laughing, while Oi danced and barked.
"Vaughn and I have never had to face the full horror of it before, Roland. We had 6, all twins, but all grown in the time between. So we may not have all the understanding needed to make such a decision as you ask."
"Being lucky doesn't make a man stupid," Eisenhart said. "Quite the contrary, is what I think. Cool eyes see clear."
"Perhaps," she said, watching the boys run back into the barn. They were bumping shoulders and laughing, each trying to get to the ladder first. "Perhaps, aye, but the heart must call for its rights, too, and a man or woman who doesn't listen is a fool. Sometimes 'tis best to swing on the rope, even if it's too dark to see if the hay's there or not."
Roland reached out and touched her hand. "I couldn't have said better myself." She gave him a small, distracted smile. It was only a moment before she returned her attention to the boys, but it was long enough for Roland to see that she was frightened. Terrified, in fact.
"Ben? Jake?" she called. "Enough. Time to wash and then come in. There's pie for those can eat it, and cream to go on top."
Benny came to the open bay.
"My dad says we can sleep in my tent over on the bluff, Si, if it's all right with you."
Margaret Eisenhart looked at her husband. Eisenhart nodded.
"All right," she said. "Tent it is, and give you joy of it, but come in now if you'd have pie. Last warning. And wash first, mind ye, hands and faces." "Aye, say thank you," Benny said. "Can I have pie?"
Margaret Eisenhart thudded the pad of her left hand against her brow as if she had a headache. The right
Roland was interested to note, stayed beneath her apron.
"I," she said, "pie for the bumbler too, as I'm sure he's Arthur Eld in disguise, and will reward me with jewels and gold and the healing touch." "Thank you, Si," Jake called. "Could we have one more swing first? It's the quickest way down."
"I'll catch them if they fly wrong, Margaret Si," Andy said. His eyes flashed blue, then dimmed. He appeared to be smiling. To Roland, the robot seemed to have two personalities, one old maidish, the other harmlessly cousining. The gunslinger liked neither, and understood why perfectly. He'd come to mistrust machinery of all kinds, and especially the kind that walked and talked.
"Well," Eisenhart said, "the broken leg usually hides in the last caper, but have on if you must."
They had on, and there were no broken legs. Both boys hit the hay pile squarely, popped up laughing and looking at each other, then foot-raced for the kitchen with Oi running behind them, appearing to herd them.
"It's wonderful how quickly children can become friends," Margaret Eisenhart said, but she didn't look like one contemplating something wonderful. She looked sad.
"Yes," Roland said, "wonderful it is." He laid his purse across his lap, seemed on the verge of pulling the knot that anchored the laces, then didn't. "Which are your men good with?" he asked Eisenhart. "Bo or Ba? For I know it's surely not the rifle or revolver."
"We favor the Ba," Eisenhart said. "Fit the bolt, wind it, aim it, fire it, 'tis done."
Roland nodded. It was as he had expected, not good, because the Ba was rarely accurate at a distance greater than 25 yards, and that only on a still day. On one when a strong breeze was kicking up, or, gods help us, a gale. But Eisenhart was looking at his wife, looking at her with a kind of reluctant admiration. She stood with her eyebrows raised, looking back at her man, looking him back a question. What was this? It surely had to do with the hand under the apron.
"Garn, tell him," Eisenhart said.
Then he pointed an almost angry finger at Roland, like the barrel of a pistol.
"It changes nothing, though, nothing. Say thank you."
This last, with the lips drawn back in a kind of savage grin. Roland was more puzzled than ever, but he felt a faint stirring of hope. It might be false hope, probably would be, but anything was better than the worries and confusions and the aches that had beset him lately.
"Nay," Margaret said with maddening modesty. "'Tis not my place to tell. To show, perhaps, but not to tell."
Eisenhart sighed, considered, then turned to Roland.
"Ye danced the rice dance," he said, "so ye know Lady Ariza."
Roland nodded. The Lady of the Rice, in some places considered a goddess, in others a heroine, in some, both.
"And you know how she did away with Grey Dick, who killed her father."
Roland nodded again. 2. According to the story, a good one that he must remember to tell Eddie, Susanna, and Jake when, and if, there was once more time for storytelling, Lady Ariza invited Grey Dick, a famous outlaw prince, to a vast dinner party in Weydon, her castle by the River Send. She wanted to forgive him for the murder of her father, she said, for she had accepted the man Jesus into her heart, and such was according to his teachings.
"You'll get me there and kill me. Be I stupid enough to come?" said Grey Dick.
"Nay, nay," said the Lady Ariza, "never think it. All weapons will be left outside the castle. And when we sit in the banqueting hall below, there will be only me at one end of the table and thee at the other."
"You'll conceal a dagger in your sleeve or a bola beneath your dress," said Grey Dick. "And if you don't, I will."
"Nay, nay," said the Lady Ariza, "never think it, for we shall both be naked." At this, Grey Dick was overcome with lust, for Lady Ariza was fair. It excited him to think of his prick getting hard at the sight of her bare breasts and bush, and no breeches on him to conceal his excitement from her maiden's eye. And he thought he understood why she would make such a proposal. His haughty heart will undo him, Lady Ariza told her maid, whose name was Marion, and who went on to have many fanciful adventures of her own.
"The lady was right. I've killed Lord Grenfell, wiliest lord in all the river baronies," Grey Dick told himself. "And who is left to avenge him but one weak daughter? Ah, but she was fair. So she sues for peace, and maybe even for marriage, if she has audacity and imagination as well as beauty.
So he accepted her offer. His men searched the banquet hall downstairs before he arrived, and found no weapons, not on the table, not under the table, not behind the tapestries. What none of them could know was that for weeks before the banquet, Lady Oriza had practiced throwing a specially weighted dinner plate. She did this for hours a day. She was athletically inclined to begin with, and her eyes were keen. Also, she hated Grey Dick with all her heart, and had determined to make him pay no matter what the cost. The dinner plate wasn't just weighted. Its rim had been sharpened. Dick's men overlooked this, as she and Marion had been sure they would. And so they banqueted, and what a strange banquet that must have been, with the laughing, handsome outlaw naked at one end of the table, and the demurely smiling but exquisitely beautiful maiden 30 feet from him at the other end, equally naked. They toasted each other with Lord Grenfell's finest rough red. It infuriated the lady to the point of madness to watch him slurp that exquisite country wine down as though it were water, scarlet drops rolling off his chin and splashing to his hairy chest. But she gave no sign, simply smiled coquettishly and sipped from her own glass. She could feel the weight of his eyes on her breasts. It was like having unpleasant bugs lumbering to and fro on her skin. How long did this charade go on? Some tale-tellers had her putting an end to Grey Dick after the second toast. His, may your beauty ever increase. Hers, may your first day in hell last 10,000 years, and may it be the shortest. Others, the sort of spinners who enjoyed drawing out the suspense, recounted a meal of 12 courses before Lady Oriza gripped the special plate, looking Grey Dick in the eyes, and smiling at him while she turned it, feeling for the dull place on the rim where it would be safe to grip. No matter how long the tale, it always ended the same way, with Lady Oriza flinging the plate. Little fluted channels had been carved on its underside beneath the sharpened rim to help it fly true. As it did, humming weirdly as it went, casting its fleeting shadow on the roast pork and turkey, the heaping bowls of vegetables, the fresh fruit piled on crystal serving dishes. A moment after she flung the plate on its slightly rising course, her arm was still outstretched, her first finger and cocked thumb pointing at her father's assassin. Grey Dick's head flew out through the open door and into the foyer behind him. For a moment longer, Grey Dick's body stood there with its penis pointing at her like an accusing finger. Then the dick shriveled, and the dick behind it crashed forward onto a huge roast of beef and a mountain of herbed rice. Lady Oriza, whom Roland would hear referred to as the Lady of the Plate in some of his wanderings, raised her glass of wine and toasted the body. She said,